My name is Ginger Feldman from High and Mighty Therapeutic Riding and Driving Center, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acra.
If you are hungry or just want to help community radio, come on out on Thursday, May 25th to Left Bank Ciders in Catskill to their community soup night. WGXC is organizing this night, Thursday, May 25th, with a live on-site broadcast, DJs, and soup. Come on out for a bowl of soup, conversation, and some music. Each Thursday night, Left Bank Ciders hosts a community soup night where volunteers make soup with proceeds benefiting a local nonprofit. All proceeds go to Waveforms WGXC 90.7 FM. On Thursday, May 25th, the Left Bank Ciders in Catskill from 5 to 7 p.m.
Brooklyn Vegan runs down the lineup for the 2023 edition of 24-Hour Drone, set for May 27th through 28th at Basilica Hudson in Hudson. The annual event has been on hold in person since 2019 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, the show is back in person with Yuka C. Honda of Cybone Matto, Wolf Eyes, Liturgy, Sarah Hines, Laura Ortman, and others performing at the event, which each year is webcast at WGXC.org and broadcast on 90.7 FM. The Basilica Hudson website has all the details about the 24-hour drone show May 27th and 28th at Basilica Hudson and will air on WGXC.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farms radio station WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture of Austerlitz, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You know, I was listening to the radio and I heard this thing.
90.7 FM, listener aided and abetted radio.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC news update. Mid-Hudson News reports that seven men have come forth to say they were paid to act as homeless veterans displaced from upstate hotels by incoming immigrants. Men were staying at a homeless shelter in Poughkeepsie and said they were among 15 men recruited for the scam by the nonprofit Yit Foundation. They were told to pretend they were veterans that had been kicked out of the Crossroads Hotel in the town of Newburgh last week before the arrival of actual migrants bused there from New York City. Assemblyperson Brian Mahar now says he was duped by Yit Foundation's director, Sharon Tony Finch, who appears to have fabricated the entire story. Mayor said on May 19th, and I quote, "When Sharon and several veterans explained to me their situation, I believed them at their word. I had absolutely no knowledge of any wrongdoing and believed that their stories were real until a phone conversation with Sharon yesterday afternoon when she explained to me that this did not happen the way she purported it to," end quote. The men said they were paid $200 and given food and alcohol to scam the public into believing that homeless veterans were being kicked out of shelters to make room for migrants. One of the homeless men said about Sharon Tony Finch, and I quote, "She told us to act like we were the veterans that had been displaced. She told us that if asked, we were supposed to say we had been kicked out and Sharon found us rooms in Fishkill," end quote. The man also said that anyone in the group who was unwilling to answer was told to respond with, and I quote, "I'm too traumatized to talk about it," end quote. The false story that migrants were displacing homeless veterans was repeated widely, both locally and nationally. Read the full story at Mid-Hudson News. Nick Reisman reports in New York State of Politics that during the COVID-19 pandemic, New York State officials made it easier for people to receive an absentee ballot, and advocates for open government would like that to continue. Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Research Group said, and I quote, "Lawmakers would have to act on legislation to extend that this year. They haven't done it yet. And the primary election is merely 6 weeks away," end quote. Primary voting this year takes place June 17th through June 27th. Common Causes' Susan Lerner agrees it should be easy for a voter to receive an absentee ballot because they do not want to be in a small room with so many other people for health reasons. And I quote, "This isn't about some special favor. This is a reasonable definition in our unfortunately highly contagious world that would be relevant, for instance, if you're a cancer patient under chemotherapy. It would be relevant if you're immune compromised. It would be relevant if you're an older person at risk of COVID," end quote. Republicans such as State Senator Mark Walczak are opposed, saying, and I quote, "We should be doing things to restore faith in the electoral process and get people out on election day," end quote. But there is no longer one single election day, but many days when voters may cast a ballot at the polls. Locally, Republicans in Rensselaer County have been charged with fraud about absentee ballots, but otherwise there have been no problems with absentee voting lately. Read more about this story in New York State of Politics. Scott Stafford reports for the Berkshire Eagle that locally allergy expert Dr. Jasdeep S. Bodwal says that, and I quote, "This spring has been particularly bad," end quote, for allergies. The specialist at Berkshire Allergy Care on South Street in Pittsfield said, and I quote, "And climate change is not helping. We are in the thick of it," end quote. The forecast of pollen count from pollen.com predicts that to remain the case this week. Carrie Nardou, professor of climate and population studies and chair of the Department of Environmental Health at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, said that pollen seasons are starting earlier and lasting longer. With more carbon dioxide in the air, plants release more pollen. Over-the-counter allergy medicines just mask symptoms, and only a series of shots can actually help those suffering. Bodwal said, and I quote, "These allergy symptoms can have a heavy impact on someone's quality of life, but a lot of people don't know that shots are available," end quote. Read more about this story in the Berkshire Eagle. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. You can visit our website at WGXE.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. While you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXE sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXE newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hiroshima's nuclear lesson, the G7 must push for peace in Ukraine. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Joe Biden's attending this year's G7 summit. With Russia's war in Ukraine and President Vladimir Putin's threats to use nuclear weapons there at the top of the agenda. The G7 comprises Japan, Italy, Canada, France, the U.S., the U.K., and Germany. Russia was briefly a member of what was then the G8, but was expelled in 2014 after its military annexation of Crimea. This year's G7 meeting is being held in Japan. Of particular note is where in Japan? Hiroshima. There, on August 6, 1945, the United States dropped the world's first atomic bomb, leveling the city and killing an estimated 140,000 people and injuring 100,000 more. As the threat of nuclear war looms as a real possibility, the world leaders gathered in Hiroshima have a responsibility to reflect on the obliteration of that city almost 80 years ago and to say no to nuclear war.
I want them, the G7 leaders, to seriously acknowledge the inhumanity of nuclear weapons. These are weapons that can destroy humankind.
85-year-old Teruko Yahata, a survivor of the Hiroshima atomic bomb, speaking this week.
I want them to strongly feel that these are terrible things and that they have to be abolished.
Prime Minister Fumio Kishida's family is also from Hiroshima, and a number of his relatives perished in the atomic blast. Survivors of the Hiroshima bomb and the one dropped on Nagasaki 3 days later, on August 9, 1945, are referred to in Japanese as hibakusha. They've been joined in their call for nuclear abolition by the Nobel Peace Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. ICAN is demanding the G7 leaders condemn any and all threats to use nuclear weapons, recognize the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of nuclear war, remove nuclear weapons from non-nuclear states, demand it also of Russia, which plans to place nuclear arms in Belarus, and to join the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. The United States and Russia, along with the 7 other nuclear-armed states, China, the UK, France, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel, refused to sign the treaty. A group of military and national security professionals just published a full-page open letter to President Biden in the New York Times under the headline, "The U.S. Should Be a Force for Peace in the World." Its 15 signatories include a retired U.S. Army Major General, President Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Soviet Union, and Dennis Fritz, a retired Command Chief Master Sergeant of the U.S. Air Force. He's the director of the Eisenhower Media Network, which organized the letter.
I've been in and out of the Pentagon since the age of 22. Now I am now 66 years old. The majority of my life has been in and out of the Pentagon. And this is probably the most fearful I've ever been with a nuclear escalation.
Chief Fritz said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
And so I take their threat of taking off their plate the use of nuclear weapons, I take that seriously. And so that is why, once again, we thought it was so important for us to send that open letter out to the president. And so our hope is to educate the American public so that they could see how we got to this point.
Another former national security advisor and military veteran is sounding alarm bells as well. Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary whistleblower who released the Pentagon Papers in 1971, revealing the secret history of U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War and the lies of presidential administrations from Presidents Eisenhower through Johnson that supported the U.S. military escalation there. Earlier in his career, Ellsberg was deeply involved in developing the U.S. military's plans for nuclear war. His book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, should be required reading. One of his greatest concerns was the dominant belief among war planners at the time that the U.S. would fare better in a nuclear war by initiating a first strike.
The belief that we can do less bad by striking first than if we strike second is what confronts us in Ukraine with a real possibility of a nuclear war coming out of this conflict.
Dan Ellsberg said recently on Democracy Now!
In other words, of most life on Earth, not all, most life on Earth being extinguished as a matter of the control of Crimea or the Donbas or Taiwan. That's insane.
Ellsberg, now 92 years old, was recently diagnosed with inoperable pancreatic cancer. He remains tireless in warning the public of the risk of nuclear annihilation. In March, he wrote, "All the young activists rising up give me hope as I leave my life. As the movement against the Vietnam War showed, young people can save lives when they make their care known in action. Keep going. The world is in your hands, he said. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts Sunday should be mostly sunny, with a high of 73 and a northwest wind 8 to 15 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Sunday night also mostly clear with a low around 50 and a northwest wind around 6 miles an hour. Monday, sunny again with a high of 72 and a low around 47. And Tuesday should also be sunny with a high near 74 and a low around 50. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
I'm joined today by Capital Region-based activist Noor and fellow organizer Daisy Cruz, who have joined forces to organize around issues of family, specifically when parental rights are revoked. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let's begin with a brief introduction of each of you, a little bit to understand who you are and how you came to this issue.
So my name is Noor, and I studied art in college. And to make a very long story short, abbreviated, there was a point that I met a woman who had attempted suicide. And I didn't know that she had attempted suicide. I only knew that she was in a wheelchair and she had burns all over her body. And I started talking to her. And from that conversation, I learned that she had been in foster care and she had left a domestic violence situation. And eventually she would have the rights to three of her children terminated. And that began this process where I went from being someone who wanted to make very beautiful films to being someone that was being called to participate in community organizing. And it's been a really hard ride, but it's also been one in where I have also used my skills in ways that I feel are much more important to our country.
My name is Daisy. I am from Tamaulipas, which is in Mexico. I was born there and raised in Kentucky most of my life. Finished high school, had six kids. And so I went through this whole process not too long ago. And just being on Facebook, I was able to find Noor. She, you know, has been a big help in my life, just getting some things done that it's different than the help that I've received. So I'm just hoping, you know, we get help and are able to help other people as well.
The two of you began working together as a way to amplify Daisy's experience. Could you share a little bit about what this experience is?
At the beginning, I told Noor I was a little bit embarrassed to talk about my situation because it's embarrassing because people start to judge you. They automatically assume that, hey, if, you know, protective services, as they, you know, they call themselves, like, come into your life, it's because obviously you did something wrong to your child, so you deserve to have them taken away. My children have tried to speak out, have tried to talk out, and, you know, me trying to be honest, I was just like, well, you know what, I suffered from postpartum depression. My daughter was a premature baby, and she was born with all these problems. But when I took her to the ER expecting help, it was the contrary. My kids, all of them, got taken away, and only two placed with my parents, but the youngest four were placed in a foster home.
Could you explain a little bit more about why two of the children were placed with your parents and the others not?
So many things have been, you know, were made up during the whole process. The evidence to prove that it was wrong, but it still wasn't heard. The last thing that was said at court was basically that my parents, since they are from Mexican descent and we are all Mexican, my parents speak Spanish. That's their fluent language. And so since my children have been placed in foster home for over 3 years now, my children don't speak Spanish, but they do understand. But they said that was the reason why, you know, here the last time that my four youngest would have to stay in foster home and not come to my parents, because my two oldest, you know, they came up with the story first that my two oldest were aggressive, and because of being in foster home, they experienced so much abuse in that home that taking up for themselves actually made them look like they were the bad kid. They were the ones, you know, being violent when it was the other way around.
So did your parents have the capacity to take all of your children?
Yes, they did. We had swapped houses. My parents were living in our home, which is a bigger home. My parents, you know, we would always be helping them pay for the bills. We moved and they stayed here. So that meant we were paying bills at the place we were at and paying for the bills here in our home and the rent and whatnot. And when the four younger kids were about to be transitioned into the home with the two oldest, they started making up, you know, things saying that we spent the night, saying that the, you know, the two oldest were a danger to their younger siblings, and just a whole bunch of other things that just eventually kept them from coming home.
And did the government give you any kind of assistance in this before they placed your children in foster care? Did they give you any kind of resources? What was that process like?
When they first came and got them at the hospital, I had my mother and I had my cousin, who is also a U.S. Born, and they were not allowed to take them. They said that they had to be taken to a foster home. When they first took them, you know, it was just difficult because all of these programs that the government does provide are usually funded with your Medicaid. You pay for them with Medicaid. But since me and my spouse are Mexican citizens, we are not U.S. citizens, we are not able to get Medicaid. So therefore, we had to pay for those classes as well. So it was a little bit hard finding classes for him since he is Spanish speaking, and you can't find those as easily. But most of them we did have to do and pay for them.
Maybe you can tell the age ranges of your children so people really get a sense of what small children we're discussing.
So my six children range right now. They are from ages 15, 12, 10, 7. Five, and the baby is three. He was only 2 months old when they took him from me. I was breastfeeding. The baby that all of this got started was because of my second youngest, who her name is Itzel. We all call her Lupita, which is, you know, comes from her middle name, Guadalupe. She was two at the time. And, you know, she was born at 7 months. She was a premature baby. My water broke when I was 17 months pregnant with her. So from there, everyone told me, you know, this baby is not going to make it. You're just not going to, it's going to be a baby that just comes out. It's going to, you should just go have an abortion. And I kept on praying until finally she was born. They had told me she was going to probably have cerebral palsy and that she would, you know, have deformed feet, possibly her legs, that she, when she was born, right after, she had a brain bleed, and they had told me that she probably wouldn't make it. That ended up resulting in a bleeding behind her eyes as well. And so from there, like, when my kids were taken from the hospital, all these injuries, they said that Lupita, who had been walking, apparently had a broken foot. Then they said fractures. They said that she had a liver laceration. They said she had a brain bleed. They said, after going to the doctor, that she also had a bleed behind her eyes. But all these other injuries that I was unaware of, when asked, how'd you get them? And I said, I do not know. That was what, you know, to them was unbelievable, because they're like, how could you not tell? But if my daughter is walking and she's not complaining, obviously I'm not going to know that she's in pain.
Thank you for sharing that. So mm-hmm. Through your experience, the two of you have come together to build a movement. Could you tell us the name of the movement? What is the mission? And what would you like to see as the outcome of your work?
Okay, so our movement, and I just want to specify this, sprung from Daisy's story. That's how important it is for me to articulate that this cannot continue, what's happening to women, especially the fact that women dream of having children. Many, many millions of women dream of having children, and to have that ripped away from you, and to have, you know, a series of lies hurled at you again and again and again. So this is an opportunity for truth telling. And not only truth-telling, but actually action happening, because there's too much talking about the matter and not action. So our movement is called Hizb al-Adal Majre Karinosa, which is Arabic and Spanish combined, both of our roots and heritages. So Hizb al-Adal means the party of the most just, which is the creator of the universe. And
Madre Cariñosa means a loving mother,
yes,
in Spanish. So to me, the movement is something that would help other families in a creative way, not just your regular, you know, let's go get it, spend money on an attorney, but find different ways to be able to help these mothers bring those kids back home, or families for that matter of fact, because a lot of grandparents are also without those children who cannot fight for them.
We are organizing a bike marathon nationally, and that's something that we are going to be working on this spring and summer for women to come out and learn of this very serious crisis that women and men, and I don't want to exclude men because men are also going through a lot of pain. And there's a lot of extreme suffering happening, for lack of better words, to men who are trying to fight for their children as well. So the ideal is just to bring a lot of attention to this issue and a lot of action. Everything counts. Everything counts in getting people to understand what's at stake. Children's wellness, their health, their lives, their happiness is at stake.
Thank you so much, Noor and Daisy, for joining us on Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. We're glad to be here.
Hello, Hudson Mohawk Magazine listeners. This is Garrett McCary. I'm presently on the fourth floor of the Capitol building, which I've never been in. Quite a wonderful place if you've ever been here. And we're here because a Senator Parker is going to be talking about community media bill, which he is proposing. So we're going to find out what that's all about. There are representatives here from BronxNet TV, and from Queen Public Television. And, of course, there's no representatives from Troy Public Access because we don't have any. This may change. I'm here with Tony Riddle. Tony has been involved in public access, community media, 40, 50 years? We don't know.
I was a community producer in 1980, so it's been since then. Wow, that is like 40 years.
It's like 43 years, Tony. Where are you working at it now?
I work at BRIC. I'm the Senior Vice President for Community Media at BRIC. BRIC is a full arts center in downtown Brooklyn. So we have not only public access community media facilities, but we also do concerts in the park. We have contemporary arts exhibits. So it's really an opportunity for community media to also explore the aesthetic side of what we do. So it's not all just talk, it's not all just social and politics, which is extremely important, but also the aesthetics of how you put stories together and how you have an effect on communities through your storytelling.
So you, why are you here in Albany today?
Okay, so the way that we've been funded is that in order to operate a cable television facility, a cable operator has to pay to run their fibers or wires either through the public ground or on poles that go over the ground. In New York City, it's mostly underground. And so, in a way, if you think about it, it's like if somebody wanted to set up a lemonade stand in Prospect Park, then they would have to pay for a franchise with the city in order to have the right to